Yeah, thanks. I would like to thank the organizers very much for giving me the opportunity here to present my work. It's been. Do you have a laser pointer or something? Oh, this one? I hold it. Great. Great, great, great. I thought it was just a pen. All right, so this is. My slides are somewhat too large. So this is work done in collaboration mainly with. Robert Wald from the University of Chicago, but we were not the only ones to work in this area recently, and these are a few people who have made significant contribution. I apologize in advance if I won't, if I forget to give the proper credit at the right places. So, as you see, this work that I'm trying to introduce you today is based on mainly four papers and maybe a couple more. All of them are fairly long, fairly technical, and fairly complicated papers in communications and mathematical physics. And you'll forgive me if I won't be able to tell you about all the details. So what I'll try is to rather introduce you to the main ideas and concepts in the subjects rather than to sort of calculation of details or mathematical technicalities. All right. So the setting is curved space-time, and why is space-time curved? It's because we know that gravity curves the geometry of space and time, and usually that is, since gravity is a rather weak force, this is barely noticeable, and a very small effect as compared to other forces in nature. But there do exist some rather weird objects, which you surely all know. They're kind of in the pop culture almost. So those are black holes. They're supposed to exist and arise from gravitational collapse of massive objects, which are supposed to just go on this cartoon version here, assuming you've never seen that. So this ellipse is supposed to represent a two-dimensional version of a massive object. Time is going up, and so as it crashes under its own weight, it'll become smaller and smaller and denser, and at some point, it'll become very dense and basically reduce into singularity. So, however, the really interesting part about this thing is that if you look at what happens to world lines of infalling observers, so these are supposed to be, say, particles that sort of try to fall onto this collapsing object, and if you imagine they send off a light signal every 2 seconds or something, which is these curvy lines here, then at some point you reach a moment where the light signal sent off cannot really go to travel all the way to infinity anymore, and sort of this happens at some surface, sort of it's a 2+1 dimensional surface, which is called the event horizon. So it's a surface that's drawn in entirely by a mathematician, so it has no local physical significance, except from the global significance that once you're beyond the surface, no light can escape to infinity. So that's then, in a word, a black hole. And such objects do indeed exist. And even in our own galaxy, we have a massive, very massive one sitting there. So mathematically, since you're mathematicians, you probably would like to know what is the mathematics behind this. So some of you probably know. So mathematically, a curved space is described by a manifold. So M is sort of space and time, the points of which, you know, the points of this represent space and time coordinates, so to speak. And the way to measure distances in this manifold is given by a metric, which formally is a two rank two symmetric non-degenerate tensor field. So in sort of somewhat more intuitive notion is you from this metric, which is sort of a rank two tensor field at each point in the space, you form this invariant length. So where dx is sort of, you think of as an infinitesimal displacement here. And the characteristics of this is that this can either be zero, so this happens for displacements lying along this kind of strange shaped cone. It can be smaller than zero, or it can be bigger than zero. If it's smaller than zero, it corresponds to directions that point into the cone. And if it's bigger than, so there should be a cone here too. And if it's bigger than zero, it points away, so out of the cone. And these respective cases correspond to going in a light-like direction, in a time-like direction, or in a space-like direction. Of course, there's a different cone attached at every point in space. So if you follow, say, along a curve that whose tangent is always light-like, you will encounter strange things like caustics, which I've tried to illustrate here, which would not, in this sense, happen inside space, but they can easily happen and do, in general, happen in a curved space because the cones that you draw in the tangent space at each point can be different. Okay, so in physics, we not just want to consider classical objects like observers following lines, but what we're really interested in most of the times are fields. And so here is an example of a field. It's called the Klein-Gordon field. It, by definition, obeys an equation like this. So this here is some curved space analog of the usual wave operator that you're all familiar with. So the wave equation minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, just a curved space analog of that. And here is some parameter m squared. You can add more parameters if you want. Anyway, so this is kind of the prototype equation for a field that is propagating in this curved space. So the point is, though, that one not only wants to study classical fields, so this classical Klein-Gordon field is a classical field. It takes on a real number at every point space. But really, in physics, we think of these fields as describing as microscopic descriptions of nature in the very small. And in that case, we also want to know what are their quantum properties. So, to an excellent approximation, actually, and basically all the way back to the Big Bang, one can treat the metric, so this G mu that I've written down for you, as a classical background field, while one quantizes the other matter fields, for example, this Klein-Gordon field. So it's a theory, it's a quantum theory, therefore, on a background field, right? So you're probably all familiar with electrodynamics on a classical photon field background, right, is somewhat analogous to that. And so why is this theory useful, or why is it important physically? So first of all, when you, for example, analyze a quantum field on a background, on a space-time that describes a black hole, this funny picture I've drawn before, you find that they're not completely black. So I claimed before that no light could escape the event horizon. But in fact, if you take into account quantum effects, so if you describe light not by just due light rays, but actually quantized photons, then you find that the black holes will emit a tiny bit of thermal radiation. And this is a celebrated effect discovered by Hawking a long time ago, actually. And, well, this is kind of an important effect theoretically, but it's a tiny effect, actually. So it's the smaller, the bigger the black hole, so the more massive the black hole. So So if you have a really big black hole, really massive, I should say, black hole, it's in the center of our galaxy, 10 to the 6 solar masses, this is such a tiny effect that it would be much below the cosmic background radiation. So it's sort of a tiny effect. But yet it's an important effect theoretically, and it is a major effect if you could have very small black holes, so of the mass of the Mount Everest or something. So, but the real, maybe more physically, more important thing is that quantum field fluctuations generate macroscopic density perturbations in the CMB as a consequence of the non-trivial expansion or dynamics of the space-time near the Big Bang. So I've drawn this picture. So here you have the moment of the Big Bang. So this is looking at that with the microscope. So there, as in this room, fields undergo tiny fluctuations, right? So the photon field in this room has tiny quantum fluctuations, which we don't care about, basically, because they're so small. But now, if you look at the dynamics of this field or this state in an expanding or in a very rapidly expanding universe, you find that they actually expand to macroscopically large fluctuations. So this is an effect that you don't have in a space-time that is not time-dependent. And so these macroscopic fluctuations are actually there, and basically they're responsible for the formation of structure in our universe, so the galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so forth. So this is a popular research topic. So Scientific American, in this August, had an article on this. And so because it's such an important effect, you really want to understand this quantum field theory in curved space-time, because that's how you basically get this. And so that's one reason why I'm interested in it. So the other reasons why I'm interested in it are sort of a more mathematical nature. So one is you get a sort of more geometrical understanding of quantum field theory and what you're used to do in quantum field theory. That, to me, is an important motivation. And another motivation for me is that it does, even though it's not a fundamental theory, so in the sense that gravity is a background field which does not obey a dynamical field equation, it's just there, okay? Nevertheless, in sort of, for example, string theory in recent years, people have considered a scenario where sort of you have a bulk quantum space-time with some sort of conformal boundary, which you can regard as a manifold in its own right, and then gravity, or quantum gravity, in this bulk is supposed to be dual or equivalent to a quantum field theory on M, which might have a non-trivial metric. So in this sense, quantum field theory does, or sort of generalization to curved space-time, does, in this sense, have the promise to even be more fundamental than just describing fields propagating on a non-trivial background. So what is, why, I mean, since people have thought about quantum field theory for so many years, you may ask, what is so special about curved space? Why do you make such a big deal? After all, you perfectly know how to do quantum fields in flat space, so what is so different about curved space then? So the basic point is not so difficult to understand, actually. And so the basic point is that in flat space, everything relies very heavily on the special symmetries of that flat space, namely the Poincaré symmetry, yeah? So the fact that you have translations, so the spaces obviously looks the same at every point, and you have Lorentz transformation. So in this respect, quantum field theory in a generic curved space-time is very different, because if you think about it carefully, what you always do is, in flat space, you look at vacuum state or its correlation functions. But in a curved space, there isn't a preferred vacuum state. Why is that? Because if you think about it, how do you define the vacuum state? You define it basically as, you can think of it as the ground state of the Hamiltonian. Now, the Hamiltonian is closely related to time translations. And in a curved space, as I just said, you just don't have any time translation invariance. So you can think of that as you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which not only is time-dependent, but it also depends on what your choice of the time coordinate is, which is completely arbitrary, right? So similarly, there's no preferred Hilbert space representation for similar reasons. People also like to consider S matrices in flat space, so there's scattering matrices. So that has problems too in general, because an S matrix, by its sort of the very idea, is somehow that free undisturbed particles come in, do something, and finally emerge as free particles again. And if you have a space-time that is not asymptotically flat or in the past or future, those, you never have free incoming or outgoing particles. So there's also some technicalities which are not to be underestimated. So, for example, you don't have momentum space techniques in a straightforward way on a curved space-time, obviously, because you want to take a Fourier transform, but in which coordinates are you supposed to take the Fourier transform? Well, there aren't any preferred coordinates. So, again, energy and momentum, you don't know how to define that because that's related to symmetries, space-time symmetries. And also, maybe something that bothers me is that in flat space, we all understand that Euclidean methods are somehow very useful, and they're useful both at a technical level, because, you know, Euclidean integrals are easier done than Lorentzian integrals, and also it has this nice feature that it gives sort of the statistical mechanics interpretation of quantum field theory, because the generating functional for the vacuum correlators can be viewed as some partition function, statistical mechanics partition function, of course. So in a curved space, well, what you need to do to apply this Euclidean method, so you have to make the space-time a Euclidean space-time, which means the metric isn't...
Riemannian,
yes. So normally in flat space you do that, you just put t time to it, and that takes care of the awkward minus sign in the metric, makes it a Euclidean metric. But clearly, in a curved space, you know, the metric doesn't even have to be analytic. In general, isn't. So, you know, the analytic continuation doesn't work. And even if it's analytic, if you put t to it in some coordinates that you choose, you just don't get a real Riemannian metric out. You get some complex metric. So it doesn't work except for some very highly special space-times that are basically static. Or at least I don't see any straightforward way to do it that isn't totally artificial at some level. So those are basically the problems, and I think you can all basically understand that. And the punchline is that you somehow force a new formalism which emphasizes the local properties of field observables, but is not based from the outset on global concepts such as a vacuum state, particle interpretation, S matrix, and so forth. I named a few in the previous slide. And so the basic ideas how to do that have been sort of developed, I would say, over the last 10 years or so, or 5-10 years. And so now I'll try to explain those in this talk. So one key idea is to sort of use some sort of algebraic formulation. The other idea is that fields, in some sense, should be thought of as generally covariant as opposed to Poincaré invariant, as is usually thought in a curved space. And then there's also some mathematical input that's proved to be very useful, at least at some level, which goes under the name micro local analysis. It's some branch of mathematics analyzing the singularity structure of distributions of various sorts. Okay, and those are some papers in this direction, most not exclusive list. And let me anticipate what are the results of this enterprise so far. So what we've been done is we have mostly looked at perturbative approach to quantum field theory. Well, not because we particularly like it, but because even in flat space, getting any non-perturbative results is very difficult, and it's surely not easier in curved space. But even perturbative methods don't generalize straightforwardly, or you have to think about it quite hard to make any sense of it. And that's what we've been done. So we have performed, in principle, the perturbative construction of interacting quantum field theories in arbitrary globally hyperbolic spacetimes to arbitrary orders in perturbation theory. Of course, there are lots of integrals to do, which the previous talk was about, and which we, of course, haven't done. But it's more the question of how do you proceed in principle, what is the algorithm, how do you eliminate divergences, and so forth. I'm going to talk about that. There emerges a sort of geometrical version of renormalization group in this context, which I'm going to describe. One wants to analyze physical fields, in particular special fields. So in particular, one wants to analyze the energy momentum tensor of the theory. So that's some tensor field which for a scalar field would look like, for a massless scalar field would look something like this. And then interaction terms. So if the theory is not linear, it will have nonlinear terms in it. And so what you want is, you all know engaged theories, or many other theories, you similarly have currents, right? And so typical issue is there whether the current is conserved in perturbation theory. So if it's classically conserved, it needn't be conserved quantum mechanically, as you all know, which is, and it's normally a hard business to show that a current is conserved to all orders in perturbation theory, right? So a similar analysis has to be done for the energy momentum tensor. And basically, the way to think about it is as some sort of renormalization condition that you have to put in. So basically, the question here is, can you satisfy various Wardet entities to arbitrary orders? We have constructed an operator product expansion, or given an algorithm how to compute that. And then there's some results of some more general nature, which are basically independent of perturbation theory. It's the formulation and proof of a PCT theorem in curved space, which you have to think about really what you mean by P, if P is not space reflection or anything in a straightforward way anymore. And then there's some nice work on so-called quantum inequalities by Fuster, which I'm not going to have time to talk about. Okay, so.
Have found some metric, the source of the non-analyticity that you mentioned previously?
Well, the basic reason is that, so usually what you do is you take some classical solution to Einstein's equation, right, as your background, with some matter field, and those in general just don't have to be analytic. They can have square roots in them and things like that. Right. So, just to take this example. You have some metric, which is sort of minus some dt squared plus some the prototype metric for an expanded universe plus some spatial part, right? So this would be some spatial part. A of t is some function. Now, what you were going to try was, you know, you define tau equals it and see if by any chance you can get rid of that minus sign, right? So obviously you get rid of that minus sign here. But now, okay, even assuming A of t is analytic, what this becomes is sort of, if this isn't analytic, you're going to have trouble what you even mean by A of I t, right? And if this is something like, right, you're not even going to get something real in general, right? That's the problem, basically. Okay, so what is this algebraic formalism? I mean, this is all, the real interest is, of course, in interacting theories, but I'll try to basically tell you the basic ideas and some, you know, just the bare bones, so to speak, in some very simple cases. So let's just therefore look at a free field, which is the free Klein-Gordon field. So as we said, it's kind of a bad idea to go ahead and try to define the quantum field theory in terms of correlation functions because you don't know what state you're supposed to take. So let's try to define it by some more abstract and I claim more invariant properties. So, well, phi of s, I think of as this type of integral expression. So the integration is just necessary because phi of x is sort of a distribution in nature. It's well understood. So you take this kind of average, looked at this averaged object just for mathematical convenience. So you want the Klein-Gordon equation in some distributional sense. So you put the operator here, and then that morally implies that the field itself satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation because you can do an integration by parts. And then you want it to be Hermitian, just part of the requirement that's the real field. And then the key equation is that you want the commutator. So if you take the commutator of two guys, you want this to be the commutator function. Now, what is the commutator function? It's just a retarded minus advanced fundamental solution to this Klein-Gordon equation in the given curved space-time. And the point is that this is always defined. It doesn't depend on any state or anything. It's always defined as long as the space-time is so-called globally hyperbolic, so no closed time like loops and strange things like that. Okay, so then you talk about states in the next step. So this is just your structure. And states then are just certain functionals on this algebra, which I call A of mg, m is the space-time, g. Well, they're normalized and they're positive, so this is just Hilbert space positivity. And A is supposed to be any expression that you can form from this field, phi of f, phi of h, and so forth. Okay, so that is the definition of a Klein-Gordon field in curved space-time, and it's almost trivial, basically. So what is this idea about local? So that's the algebraic part. So I mean, that's only trivial, of course, for free fields, but I think the idea is quite obvious. So what about then this idea that fields are generally covariant, or call that local covariant fields. So as I said, that's the idea somehow if you consider quantum fields in general, normally you would say that they have to be transformed covariantly under the Poincaré group. And here, you don't have the Poincaré group, but yet you want some similar condition. Otherwise, your notion of quantum fields is way too general. And so what the basic idea is that you... Well, it's presented here in some very abstract way, but it can actually be boiled down to computational algorithms. So you consider situations where you have a space-time which is so-called isometrically embedded into a larger space-time, which is just supposed to mean that it can be viewed as like a sub-manifold in its own sub-space-time in its own right in the larger space-time. Okay, so now then for the Klein-Gordon field, and even in much more generality, you can show that with each such embedding, there is a corresponding identification of the algebra of all fields of the smaller space-time into the one with of the bigger space-time, okay? So it's technically an injective star homomorphism between, okay, this whole construction has some obvious functorial properties for the guys here, like in Pooler into mathematics, so that's not so important. So the point is that you now can say what is a local covariant field, and you just say it's a field. I call them always O as a sort of common nowadays. If sort of, it has to be defined not just for a given space-time, but for all space-times at the same time. And the idea is that if you construct it here, then transport it over there, then this is to coincide precisely from the field that you would have constructed here. So this precisely encodes the idea that if you want to look at the field at this point here, you don't have to know whether this little patch of space-time is embedded in this bigger space, which with a different topology, for example, and certainly a different metric, or, you know, it could have 10,000 handles here. You're supposed to not to have to know that. All you have to know is this, the metric in this region, and this idea is, if you think about it, the way I've set it up, that's the right way to formulate this idea. So, let me explain what is the usefulness of this. So, that's so far just an abstract concept, but it's actually useful. So, for example, consider composite fields. So, in this free field theory still, so look at just the simplest example, it's just the square of the field, right? It's a composite field. So, if you took just the square in this algebra, remember this is the distribution, you don't get a meaningful result. So, that's a very familiar fact, right? If you square a quantum field theory, that's not a really good idea. So, therefore, you try something else. You don't take the square in a straightforward way, but you take the product at nearby but not coinciding points. And then, if you now would set x primed equals to x, you'd get this divergence. But you get rid of that by subtracting something which kills off that divergence, right? So you call this h. So this is a point split expression, and this is a subtraction piece. Now, you can show that this field then is an element in some larger algebra, so it's some algebra W, which is a distribution algebra. It can be viewed as deformation quantization of classical Poisson algebra, blah, blah, blah. There's some mathematics here. But the key point that I want to make is that it's not so clear what thing you have to take here, because you could take, basically, if you have something that works, you could add to it anything that has a finite coincidence limit, and that also works. And basically, therefore, you have a tremendous ambiguity in how you're going to define this, right? Okay, so what is now the way to get rid of that ambiguity? So the idea is, at least partially, what you use is the local covariance principle. So now you say, well, I just don't just want something B squared that I just cook up, but I want something that is a local covariant field in the sense that I've just described. And that leads you to demand, this is equivalent to taking H's here that are locally and covariantly constructed from the metric, yeah? Just from the metric in a close neighborhood of this point X that you're interested in. So this sounds innocent, but it's actually quite a, you know, if you think about it, so in particular, if you think about it a bit more carefully, you find that H is not the expectation value for this reason. It's not the expectation value of any expectation value of a point split product. Yeah. So basically, normal ordering is incorrect in curved space. So that's kind of one way to say it. So because in Minkowski space, what you can take here is the expectation value in the vacuum of this product. That does the job, as you probably all know. But as I said, you want to do it for all space-time, and then this is not the expectation value of phi in any state, because that would fail to be locally constructed. So vacuum is always a global quantity. Yeah? It depends on everything, on how many handles the space-time has and so forth, yeah? For example. Okay, this is of course just the simplest non-trivial case where some renormalization issue arises, but you can easily see that if you now want to do a perturbative formulation, this same problem is going to crop up sort of in much more complicated way at higher orders. But the basic idea how to reduce that ambiguity is this. Now maybe a little more on this to sort of get the give you the flavor what you do. So now I told you the imposition of local covariance property reduces the ambiguity in P squared to making a redefinition of this form. So you add something C that is not completely arbitrary, but it has to be a local curvature expression of some sort. Yeah, it might actually be an operator at this stage even. Okay, so this is still a big ambiguity, so you're not content with that, so you better impose some further conditions, right? You could cook up something, but it's much more clean to first say what you want and then, right, and then try to see how much that reduces the freedom. So one is scaling conditions, sort of, I'll come to that later, basically dimensional analysis in some way. And the other thing is you want a commutator relation for the sphere phi squared of this form, and you see immediately that this will then boil down the ambiguity in this C to be just a C number expression, yeah, something that commutes. And you also want some sort of analyticity. Analytic dependence on the metric, not on the space-time. And if you impose all that, which you can do in a much more clean fashion than I indicate here, you find the ambiguity is basically just this. So it's the freedom of adding something proportional to the identity, where the proportionality is an m squared term for the mass that's dimensionally right, and a scalar curvature r formed from the metric. So actually, similar analysis can be performed for any composite field in the free field theory. But you know, the basic idea is just this. The ambiguity looks somewhat more complicated, but it's just this. So, but how about interacting fields? That's where the real interest is, of course. And so, let me, for the rest of the talk, how much more time do I have? 20 minutes, something like that?
30. Supposed to go to 10 minutes after.
Oh. Uh-huh. All right. Okay. So now, what about interacting fields? So, interacting fields. So you could classically describe them by an action. So these two things would correspond to the free fields that I've just been talking about all the time. But now you want to add some interaction. So it's just some coupling constants FA and some composite operators OA. So there's a monomial in field, its covariant derivatives, blah, blah, blah. So what you want to construct is now some algebra called the interacting field algebra, so to speak, which depends, of course, on the action, which here I call S and here I call I for some reason. It's supposed to be S both places. So what are these supposed to be? So that you want the interacting quantum fields. They're supposed to be elements of this algebra. And actually, it turns out this algebra is going to be a subalgebra of this strange Wick polynomial algebra, basically, with the additional twist that you allow formal power series in the couplings. Okay. Right. And F is just some local field observable. It's some operators smeared with or averaged with some functions. Yeah. And the subscript S is supposed to mean it's not the free field, but it's the field that interacts according to this classical interaction, which here I called I. I don't know why I called it I. It should be S. Okay, so now you can write a formal solution to this, what this interacting field is, and you can write it as some formal power series. So it's got this form, so the power series, the n is sort of the perturbation order. It's the order in the coupling constants up to which you expand. And then it's supposed to be some things called retarded products, which are somewhat similar to time order products that you're probably all familiar with. And then it depends on which field you're actually considering here. Okay. So the retarded products, similarly to the time order products, can be written down as formal expressions, right? The time order products you're probably familiar with are formal in the sense that if you, in the same sense that the square of a field is a formal expression, because if you actually square the field, you get infinity, right? And so similarly for the time order product, although the nature of the singularity is somewhat different. And just by analogy, the same happens for this Rn. And so one way to proceed, and this is the way we proceed, which I think is the cleanest way, and actually, even for practical purposes, the most suitable one, if you say, well, let's not consider these formal expressions for Rn that I could write down for you, but let's figure out what do I really want, as I did before. So what is it that I want, actually? So I write down some properties that I would like to have. And so one property that you can deduce formally from these formal expressions is that some causality property. So remember, the Rn depended on the field F here. F is this interacting field that I want to consider, which is smeared, which is averaged by some function h. So h is sort of supported in some space-time region, right? And so one condition, one property is that if this is the support where this interacting, where average this interacting field, and if this is the support of the interaction, so I'm assuming that you, at a first stage, consider, instead of coupling constants, I consider coupling functions which localize the interaction to some region. So if the interaction is supported outside of the past causal shadow of the place where I want to evaluate the field, I'm supposed to get zero. Okay, then there is some complicated looking functional relation that is analogous to the commutator relation that I've written down for you earlier. The details don't matter. I just want to give you confidence that there is some fairly definite thing that you can write down and evaluate. Then there are scaling properties, and so this is basically dimensional analysis. So you want them to satisfy some obvious rules that you would infer from dimensional analysis. So what is dimensional analysis? It's basically scaling, right? So you scale the length, suppose you parameterize everything in terms of length, then you scale the length normally, right, or momentum if you want. And so in curved space, you can't just straightforwardly scale the length. So what you would normally do is you take x mu and then you put it to lambda x mu, or momentum if you want. And you would analyze how some expression would depend on such a scaling. That's dimensional analysis, basically, right? If you have dimension for couplings, like M, you also scale them in the appropriate way. Okay. Now, in curved space, you know, what is X mu? X mu is a coordinate, right? So which coordinate are you supposed to scale? So there are tons of coordinate systems, right? Are you supposed to scale polar coordinates? Or are you supposed to scale the angles? Are you supposed to scale Cartesian coordinates or whatever, ellipsoidal coordinates? You know. Right. Don't do that. So the real thing you want to do is you want to step back and say, in general relativity, if you have two points, you know, there is no, just given the points and the manifold, there's just no way to say this is close or, you know, this is far, you know. This is, what you have to say is this is 1 millimeter apart or 1 kiloparsec apart, and the way you do that is you look at the metric, right? So now the way to scale distances, therefore, is you just scale the metric. You don't scale coordinates, right? So you keep the points where they are, you just scale the metric. And so then if I scale by 100, all, even though the points sit at the same, sit where they are, I now think they're 1/100th apart, 1/100th of the original distance apart. So this is how you do, just take the metric, multiply with some lambda squared, lambda constant, and you ask how do these, and you similarly do the same thing for the dimensionful couplings, and you ask how are these things supposed to depend on the scaling. So now, normally you'd say, well, dimensional analysis would tell you just a straight scaling law, yeah? Lambda to the appropriate engineering dimension. But that doesn't work. So the best you can achieve, it turns out, is that you can scale homogeneously, so the way dimensional analysis would tell you, up to a polynomial in the logarithm of lambda. So this is sort of a quantum effect. But it's just a polynomial at every given order in perturbation theory. And then you also want these things to be local and covariant fields, obviously. Multi-local now, but that's just a detail. Okay, so what else do you want? I'm continuing my list of what you want from these things. So you want certain Ward identities for the products containing the stress tensor already discussed. You want to specify the possible singularities a bit further. And that you will do, as I'll explain later, with some mathematics stuff, which is called microlocal analysis, microlocal spectrum condition. And so what is then the main result is that basically the construction of these retarded products with all the desired functional relations is possible to all orders in perturbation theory, and therefore any interacting field can be constructed to arbitrary orders in perturbation theory, and it is a local covariant field with nice properties. Okay, so what are the basic steps in this construction? So it's basically, you know, you want to carry out Well, they're Weidman axioms, if you want. You know, they're just properties, general properties you want to ascribe to some correlation functions. Now, I've told you how to define those things, but I haven't told you what state you should pick here, right? So normally, you would choose a vacuum state here, a thermal state, and 2-particle in state, a 7-particle out state, whatever you want. I haven't told you what, right? And it's in general just not possible to say in simple words what you take, right? That's the problem. But I've certainly told you, well, I haven't told you, but I've claimed you can define the operators, and then in principle, you have tons of states, and you can sit down. It's your duty now to sit down and ask yourself the question. No. Well, this is not no axioms here, right? This is a construction, right? I've just presented it to you as, you know, not do this and, you know, follow this cook recipe. I've presented it to you. What do you want from these things? And can you actually do it? And I just claim that you can do it, but it's a construction. It's not a question of, it's a conturbative construction. It's not some, you put on some axioms for something you don't know anything. Right, so it does satisfy all reasonable things, so it satisfies the interacting fields, say, commute at space like separate. You can, in a curved space, you can still talk about when 2 points are space-like separated, right? And they still commute by construct. That's how they're constructed. And similarly, one of the Haag-Hausdorff axioms is that fields transform under the Lorentz group in a suitable way. Well, now that's clearly out of the window. But as I described, you now know by construction the fields a general or local n covariant, as I explained, in the sense that I explained. Everything in the Haar-Kastler axioms that somehow makes reference to this vacuum state, right? So the axioms also tell you that the correlation functions are Lorentz invariant, right? That is out of the window because the correlation functions of fields in curved space in any state are never local and covariant. They always depend on global properties of the state. Okay. So, but I should, again, I want to emphasize, this is an actual construction. It is just, I'm giving you the bare bones, so it looks like some, I'm just putting up some axioms, but it's an actual construction that is behind this. I'm just presenting it to you to make it more clear. So, I mean, it's just a situation where you first have to get clear, what do you really want? That's sort of an one step. And then the second step is, can you do it, right? And the can you do it thing I'm going to try to describe in one transparency, and that's kind of the body of these long papers that we've written, basically. But so what are the basic steps in the algorithm? So normally one would write down Feynman diagrams and renormalize them, but you know, clearly the Feynman diagrams involve propagators. What are the propagators? Well, they're two-point vacuum functions. You don't do that, so you do something else. So you construct them inductively. Well, one way is to construct them inductively in the perturbation order. So first for free fields, I've already told you how to define phi squared, and you could now do it for phi to the 4 and whatever you want. Now, then you want to first order in perturbation theory. Then once you've done that, you do it for the next and so forth. Okay, so the point is that you can see just from the functional relations that if you have it at, say, first order, you have these guys at second order almost uniquely. Just from the functional relations, there isn't too much you can do. But there is a problem because these things, if you just go by the functional relations, you can only define them up to, you know, remember these guys depend on n plus one space-time points, right? And so they're only defined, you see, for up to configurations where all the points coincide. They're just not defined for this configuration. Right? So that's basically the issue of renormalization. So if there wasn't a need for renormalization, you would have them also at this, what is called the total diagonal, because for obvious reasons, it's just called the total diagonal. So now the next step, therefore, is to extend this thing to the total diagonal. And here is where you, that is where all the renormalization happens. Okay. And basically, the point is you want to do it in such a way as to not destroy your nice functional relations, which guarantee all the nice properties of the interacting fields. Okay. And so basically, the way you do it is this. So you take this retarded product. It depends on n plus 1, or now n plus 2 space-time points, actually. And you show that the dangerous part, so where this has possibly divergences, can be expanded. And it can be expanded in the following way. So you take a reference point, y, say, and then it can be expanded in terms of local guys sitting at y. So these are curvature polynomials and local operators at y, thanks, times some Minkowski space guys. Right, so this is just an asymptotic expansion. Right? It's not certainly not a convergence, but it just captures the dangerous singular part. And so these are functions of the relative coordinates. So you take your point y, and then you define in the tangent space relative coordinates, which you map to points on the manifold by just basically following the geodesics here. Okay, so you can prove that this, you have such an expansion. And now these things are Minkowski space distributions, very similar to Feynman integrals, yeah, actually. And now the whole problem, these are just curvature expressions, so Riemann tensor, some complicated derivatives of the Riemann tensor, which you can compute. But this thing here now is not defined on this diagonal, which corresponds to when all the xis are zero. Uh-huh. And there is where you have to now do a renormalization. But the point is that you can now carry this out, so to speak, in the tangent space. Yeah, so it's reduced to a problem in flat space. No, the operators sit in the C. This is just an asymptotic expansion. This has some finite part, right, which, you know, at this stage is given, but now you have to take it. Okay, so just to give a more detailed picture how this works. So just a bit bigger, so you have this U's. So the picture is you have this reference point, you have the tangent space here. In the tangent space, you have this relative coordinates, which you map to points along geodesics. And then the distributions U are just numerical distributions living in this tangent space, which you readily identify with R4, simply, Minkowski space. And this is just for 2 points, but you can obviously have do the same for arbitrary number of points. And so this thing is defined, except when Xi1, Xi2 equals 0, it has some nice scaling you can show. So it scales as some obvious power plus some polynomials in the logarithms. And you can prove you can renormalize these things in the same way. I won't give you any details. So the thing that lives at this point y is some polynomial in the Riemann tensor times some certain operators. Okay. You don't have to do anything to that here. Okay, this is just in a nutshell what you do. Of course, the actual process requires doing integrals and complicated things, but this is just the bare bones of what you do. So as I said, once you have the RNs, you have the interacting fields to arbitrary orders. But as in flat space, as you already had in the free theory, you have ambiguities, which are now of a form that is very similar to the ones in the free field theory, but that's a little more complicated. But one, so there, now let me quickly mention two properties that of this whole construction that come out immediately. So construction is made so that this is going to come out, basically. So one is the renormalization group. So now what is this in this curved space? So I've already told you renormalizing means considering things at different length scales, right, or energy scales equivalently, right? So as I said, you want to not change coordinates, but you want to change the metric, right? You do that, and then you want to analyze what happens to the theory if you change this metric, right? So you might expect, well, classically, it is just a trivial change, so you can absorb it in simple redefinition of fields. But quantum, all magic is that quantum mechanically, or quantum field theoretically, something else happens. So basically, what you want to compare at a very abstract level is sort of the algebra of fields associated with this rescaled metric and the algebra of fields associated with the original metric. Okay, and you might think they're just the same up to some trivial rescaling, as would be the classical case. But actually, to make them the same, you also have to change the interaction, which means somehow the interaction is just a lambda phi to the 4, or, you know, whatever the interaction is. And with lambda, and so the way you have to change it corresponds precisely to the running of couplings, yeah? So the lambda is sort of the running, sliding scale or whatever. And the way this coupling, so this S means the couplings basically, depend on this, gives you the renormalization group. And the sense in which this is, in some sense, a property of the theory is that, right, you change the scale and you change the interaction and you leave everything unchanged, right? So this is the version of the renormalization group in curved space. And so what interests, we have to look what this isomorphic, just how is this implemented? So some interacting field, you know, always just some label of the fields. Yeah, just it gets mapped to some linear combination of fields with this new interaction, and the CAB is just what it would be normally called the mixing matrix. So it's a formal power series whose coefficients are polynomials in curvature tensors and logarithm of lambda. Okay, so these are, I've already explained. So then another, I'm coming to the end, so this is my last slide. So you also can establish that the fields obey an operator product expansion, like so, where you can basically compute these coefficients. They now depend on the geodesic distance and on curvature quantities and so forth. And let me just flash my conclusions. Is there a question? So what have we done? We have perturbatively constructed, or at least outlined an algorithm how to do it. Of course, the actual construction at the end of the day requires you to do complicated integrals, as usual, and you know, I'm not any better than that than anyone else. And we showed how to formulate and what is basically the renormalization group in curved space. I've just told you that you can compute, prove the existence, or if you want in mathematical terms, of an operator product expansion. You can prove that all the water densities for the stress tensor hold. In the future, I would really like to apply this formalism to quantum gauge theories in the early universe. That's really where this is going. And I think up to the treatment of gauge invariants, which already is not so easy in flat space, this, all the ingredients are there. I haven't had time to comment on the nice mathematics behind this construction, so there's some, well, number theory, ignore that maybe, but there's microlocal analysis, there's algebra, there is lots of geometry, and they all fit together in a rather nice way, in my opinion, but that's always a matter of opinion. And I think it does sort of make the, even, I mean, just if you go to flat space, make the usual constructions in flat space look somewhat more geometrical and invariant. I think that's sort of a spin-off. I mean, not certainly the reason why I'm doing this. But let me come to the biggest open problem, which I seriously hope to get some input from the experts on constructive quantum field theory, of which there are not very many in the world. And so the biggest problem is, of course, how you go beyond perturbation theory, I mean, as is of course in flat space. And so formally, right, what I've done, everything were formal power theories in the couplings, but now you want to go to actual real functions in the coupling. And, well, my basic problem, well, there's some speculation as to which, that there might be some local quantities that actually might have convergent power theories, but let's not focus on this. But the real difficulty I have is to even get an idea to how to get started if one were to make some constructive, try to some constructive approach, even in low dimensions, say. Because it seems to me, from my relatively limited knowledge, that all these approaches very heavily based on the Euclidean, either some Euclidean approach or proving that various Hamiltonians are self-adjoined, which is the original stuff by Gim and Jaffe. So now the Hamiltonian, you know, that's clear, doesn't work in a time. And the Euclidean also does not look very useful here. I mean, maybe there's some. So I really don't know even what would be the starting point, let alone all the sort of technicalities maybe that would ensue. So I would really be happy to get some input from the experts here. Thanks.